This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, at Google, at Stitcher, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or just go to reason.com/podcasts. And while you're there, check out the Reason Roundtable and the Soho Forum debates.
And science tells us that how we act or fail to act in the next 12 years will determine the very livability of our planet.
That's Joe Biden, the Democratic nominee for president, who's currently leading Donald Trump in the polls by double digits and thus is the favorite to become the next occupant of the Oval Office. If there's one consistent message coming from activists and politicians pushing the Green New Deal and massive new subsidies for renewable energy, it's that if we don't take radical action now, life on Earth as we know it will soon be irreversibly destroyed. But such fear-mongering is flat-out misleading, and the findings of scientists studying global warming don't support such alarmist claims, according to the new book, Apocalypse Never. Authored by writer and activist Michael Schellenberger, the book argues that deforestation and deaths from extreme weather are actually declining, and that concerns about environmental damage from plastics are fundamentally misplaced. Schellenberger, who began his career as an advocate for more government spending on wind and solar, was eventually disillusioned after witnessing the failure of subsidies to fix the inherent drawbacks of renewables. Named a hero of the environment by Time magazine in 2008, Schellenberger is an expert reviewer on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He also appeared in the 2013 documentary Pandora's Promise, which was shown at Sundance and featured several prominent environmentalists who have come around to see the virtues of nuclear power. For today's podcast, I talked with Schellenberger about his new book and why he believes that environmentalism has become a replacement for religion in an increasingly secular world. All right, Michael Schellenberger, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me.
So your book is Apocalypse Never, subtitled Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All. Give me the elevator pitch of the book.
I mean, the elevator pitch of the book is that everything they told us about the environment is wrong. Often it's the opposite of what they said. Climate change is real, but it's not the end of the world. It's not even our most important environmental problem. Poverty, underdevelopment, bad government are the biggest factors driving environmental degradation, the same factors behind poverty and disease and all the things we're familiar with. But more proximate problems that are much more serious, in my view, is the continued use of wood as fuel by 1 to 2 billion people in the 1 to 2 billion people in the world. The overeating of wild animals in general, certainly wild fish. The oceans are in much worse shape than many people realize. But just the kind of poverty that pushes people into forests to farm and use wood as fuel and eat wild animals are really underappreciated threats. And the solutions are industrialization and urbanization. The solutions are moving away from renewables towards fossil fuels and eventually towards nuclear, which is obviously the best form of energy. And that trajectory, the physical hierarchy of energy and the moral hierarchy are just perfectly overlapped. It's not, I don't know any other discipline or any other science that shows this so clearly, that one's life is deeply improved by moving from wood to fossil energy. And then one's life is further improved by becoming French and getting most of your electricity from nuclear.
That's that's a bold claim to say that we need to become French in order to improve the future or to have a future. But, you know, there's a lot of claims there, and I want to work through some of them. The book is, and I'll congratulate you up front. It is, I mean, it's both kind of a memoir, but it's also a policy book, and you do a really great job of blending them. Your personal story is really interesting because you are an environmentalist. Can you talk a bit about why you are interested in preserving improving the environment and how that stems out of earlier political commitments?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm going to give away the ending, but basically some of the punchline to the book is that our love of nature is irrational. There's no justification. And I criticize conservationists for somehow suggesting that the continued existence of yellow-eyed penguins or mountain gorillas are somehow important to human civilization, that if those species went extinct, that somehow it'd be like a Jenga puzzle, and then the human civilization would crash down. Suddenly we wouldn't have roads and electrical systems and sewage systems and whatever. And it's just ridiculous. There's no mechanism for any of it. And that the reason that we want to save these species is the same, you know, one might say it's the same reason that we preserve Van Gogh paintings, or it's the same reason that we, you know, protect old churches or something.
So it's a preference. It's a preference that we have. Is it enough to say that?
Of course, you can say that. You can say it's aesthetic. You can say it's spiritual. Mm-hmm. All those are fine to me. As an environmental activist, when we were saving redwood trees, our strategy to save redwood trees was like, here's a photo of ancient redwoods. Don't you want to save them? It wasn't, we must save these redwoods because if we don't, then, you know, the apocalypse will come and, you know, and so you kind of go, well, how do we get to the end is near? And so that traces back through the birth of what we call environmentalism, which is really the marriage of Malthusianism and socialism.
Well, can I ask to dilate a little bit on this, the kind of preference question? Early conservationists, I guess, more than environmentalists or even preservationists, would often talk about going into the woods. And of course, this happens after kind of industrialization has taken place. But you go to the woods to commune with nature, and that's a powerful feeling and a meaning. That's kind of where you're talking about the preference for keeping nature going is there. How does that then get yoked to Malthusianism and a kind of an apocalyptic alarmism about the end of, you know, the last mountaintop or the last tree, something like that?
Right. Well, so there's sort of two reversals that occur. I mean, the first reversal is that the woods go from being a place of danger and criminality that have to be conquered for God's plan, you know, in Europe, the United States, to something that is beautiful and sacred and special. So that occurs, you know, at least in Europe in what's called the early modern period between the 16th and 18th centuries. And of course, it occurs after we start living in cities.
Right.
You know, so you only appreciate the thing after you're not a victim of it.
The American Indian was never so beloved as when he was no longer a threat, right, to frontier people. Yeah.
You got it. Exactly. So, so that's the first reversal. And then we get this period of sort of conservation called aesthetic or spiritual, it doesn't matter, which lasts until about World War II. And so after World War II, there is a very powerful Malthusian drive, I would say, by elites in the West, particularly in the Anglo-American countries, but it spreads throughout Europe. And it attaches itself to a bunch of conservation concerns. And it does that in a bunch of different ways. But for the most part, conservationists in America, in the United States, and really probably in Europe as well, though we looked mostly at, I spent most time in California, the conservationists were pro-nuclear, pro-economic growth, pro-people, pro-cities. They even said things like, you have to have a lot of cheap energy to just protect nature, to just have nature. Nature takes a lot of work. You have to have the boundaries. I talk about in Congo, you know, you talk to people and you're like, how is your life? You know, just interview them, what's going on around here? And they're like, hey, what do you, and they always know because you're a big, tall white guy. They know why you're there. You're there to be at the park. And they go, can you ask the park director to put electric wire around the park? Because the wild animals keep eating my crops.
Right.
Right. So that reality, of course, still exists in really poor countries. But but managing nature turns out to be very expensive. And of course, there's opportunity cost loss. But that was the earlier view.
It's an amazing thing, if I can just interject. I know in the early 60s, when Students for a Democratic Society and their founding document, the Port Huron Statement, and the Young Americans for Freedom, their conservative counterpart that was founded by William F. Buckley and a couple of other conservatives, each of their manifestos, they assume nuclear power and essentially free, unlimited, non-polluting energy. You know, and that was, you know, in the early 60s, that's what we were looking forward to. Obviously, it didn't work out that way.
Yeah, I mean, the Port Huron Statement is so interesting because, of course, it's like small modular nuclear reactors powering suburbs.
Yeah.
Because people had escaped. At that point, they still thought the cities were these monster cities. I think that was the language they used, right? Monster cities. And then we're all going to live in suburbs powered by nuclear. Well, today, it's the exact opposite. Now environmentalists want to have cities, but powered by renewables. And we also, I show why that's physically not going to work for inherent power density reasons. But nonetheless, you get to this, these humanistic, you know, greatest generation conservationists who are overthrown in the Sierra Club, elsewhere too, but we focus on the Sierra Club because that's such a pivotal organization. And they're overthrown by the Malthusians who are anti-nuclear, whereas the earlier conservationists are pro-nuclear. And so the it took me a long time. It took me many years to get to the bottom of what that was about. But where I ultimately arrived.
Is it partly that nuclear, I mean, talk a little bit about how nuclear went from being the savior of kind of the jet age or whatever to being, you know, the ultimate thing that we had to avoid. Was it? And I mean, you talk about it at length in the book, but is it a kind of transference from nuclear power to nuclear weapons? And nuclear weapons, obviously, you know, Hiroshima, Nagasaki are the things to be avoided. We're, you know, in the post World War II era and through the 60s, we're living, you know, 15 minutes from the end of humanity and all of that kind of stuff. Is that what made nuclear energy such a pariah? Because I know people like Stuart Brand, the Whole Earth Catalog founder, Mary Prankster, important figure in the development of personal computing as a concept and a technology, was always pro-nuclear, but that went missing in the counterculture years, right?
Well, just on the case of Stuart, he changed his mind around 2009, and that was why I changed my mind. So he only changed his mind very late.
But okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think the short version is that I see two big factors animating anti-nuclear ideology really starting more strongly in the 60s. And it was first just the truly shocking nature of the bomb and the truly terrifying nature of the bomb is real. And I think some people feared it and hated it for some ideological reasons, but there is some independent, just the bomb is a very serious invention. The second is Malthusianism, which is that the problem that nuclear energy poses to Malthusians who want to control society and restrict growth and do all the things that we know what the people that call themselves environmentalists want to do, it's threatened by nuclear energy because nuclear energy means you have infinite energy, infinite fresh water, infinite fertilizer, and that means you have infinite food. So nuclear eliminates resource scarcity. Now, how much resource scarcity really was there before nuclear? I mean, it wasn't like we were ever really running out of energy. We now know we weren't running out of oil or gas or coal or any of that. So that wasn't really real necessarily. But nonetheless, I think I document basically a reaction to nuclear by Malthusians that I think is clearly motivated by a fear that basically this human cancer, in their view, the human virus, we have to cut off its power source. That was always the idea. And again, I think it's more irrational than rational. Sometimes these guys don't really pull it apart. And you're right about the transference, or I don't know if transference is, I probably shouldn't use that word because it has some sort of psychoanalytical meaning.
Right.
But, displacement, I think, is the word we use in the book, which is that the fear displaces from the bomb onto the power plants. And that's true, although it's worth noting that it's not something universally true. It's true among people who are on the left, not just the radical left either, but really this is often just mainstream liberals. And I think this comes from the kind of old Kantian view. I didn't get into it in the book necessarily, but this desire that human reason be the thing that ends war, not a technical fix, which is ultimately what nuclear is.
It gets confusing very quickly because, you know, you mentioned France. France supplies a large percentage of a vast majority of its electricity needs via nuclear power plants. And in Europe, nuclear power seems more, you know, is more acceptable. Nuclear weapons, definitely not. In the United States, nuclear power is pretty verboten. Is there a consistent thread, or is that it's Malthusianism and a dislike of a post-scarcity world, and it just takes different forms depending on the social or political context?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that countries that have the bomb are more comfortable with nuclear energy. In fact, it's not in the book because I didn't quite have the argument, but I've been looking at whether or not it could be that Japan and Germany are uniquely anti-nuclear because they weren't allowed to have it and they would like to level the playing field. Plus, I think there's some pride. I mean, look, it's the best weapon. Obviously, it's the best weapon. And Japan and Germany, as anybody that's spent any time there knows, these are these are people that are deeply committed to excellence and have deep pride in doing the best of everything. And here they are denied the best weapon.
Before we get to the apocalyptic turn, because that's really what your book, you know, in its title, it's Apocalypse Never. You're confronting that. That's certainly the contemporary political discourse. Talk a little bit about how you individually grew to be an environmentalist and, why it matters to you.
I mean, yeah. So for me, you know, just probably boring like everybody, my parents took me camping a lot. So I loved being out. I loved nature, you know, and they were sort of, I think my mom was still Christian. My dad was more post-Christian, but out of the Mennonite tradition, which is a pacifist, anti-statist libertarian tradition, by the way.
Right. Yeah, very much so. And I'm happy to see you wearing buttons. You've gotten past that, right?
Progress. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, in some ways, I always felt like I had a very basic morality. I never believed. I was never Malthusian. You know, I just was never. People would say there's too many people in the world, and that always struck me as racist. I know they would be like, no, and of course there's too many, you know, rich white people too, and you'd always be kind of like, yeah, but it seems like all the sterilization camps are in India. You know, it's like, right. Doesn't seem like this is evenly distributed concern. But I was definitely had a more apocalyptic view, and you know, I trace that in some ways to just the bomb. I mean, I'm a Gen Xer. I don't know. I was born in 1971, so by 1980, the movie The Day After, I think, is 1983. So I was like 12 in this movie. The ABC encourages parents to watch this movie with their children, and it just like whatever, you know, 15 minutes in, it's just. I mean, and they show like classrooms of children being carbonized,
right?
You know, so
school's out. You know,
exactly. So that was definitely there. And my dad was more left wing than my mom. I read Chomsky at like 17 and went to Nicaragua at 17 to work, you know, help the Sandinistas. And so I think the apocalypticism also comes from socialism or Marxism a bit too, which is a kind of view that, you know, of course there will be this, the coming of the kingdom of heaven, except for it'll be communism or socialism in the transition phase. So I had all of that. You know, I think there was a bunch of things. I mean, in the book I talk about just living with small farmers and trying to be a revolutionary socialist with small farmers. You discover small farmers are like, they're not on board necessarily with collectivization. You know, they've got their own farm. You know, they don't really even want their brother telling them how to do it, you know? That was a big deal. Seeing kind of the difference between first world problems and third world problems, which most people never experience in poor countries, had a big impact. And it just became clear that like a lot of environmentalists were just putting nature ahead of lifting people out of poverty, and that was unethical. And in fact, the humans had to always come first, because otherwise, you know, bad things happen and bad things are justified. And so I think I think another big moment was just changing my mind about nuclear. And once you can change your mind about nuclear, you kind of go, there's an aha moment that goes, oh, so we don't have to spread all these crappy renewables all over our deserts and forests. We don't have to grind up all this nature for climate change. You can just have nuclear power plants. And once you understand how power density works and that it's good to move up the energy ladder from wood and dung to coal to oil to natural gas to uranium, and that intensified agriculture produces more food on less land, there's kind of a picture that you get. And it was that picture that I had, and it just took a while to be able to actually turn it into the book.
Let's talk about contemporary alarmism. In October, and these are quotes that are in the book, Apocalypse Never, October 2018, Greta Thunberg, in 2019, in October of 2018, a UN IPCC report comes out, which was widely kind of misinterpreted to say we have 12 years left. Greta Thunberg in 2019 says, I want you to panic about the imminent end of the world. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was pushing the Green New Deal along with Senator Martin O'Malley, a Democrat from Massachusetts or Maryland, but she says the world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change. they're wrong. How can you, according to you, they're wrong? What is the brief argument of how wrong they are?
So the two most important things anybody needs to know about climate change are that deaths from natural disasters have declined 90% over the last 100 years. They've declined 80% over the last 40 years, including in very poor countries. We should be celebrating this like every day of the week. Tiny amounts of people are swept away in floods and hurricanes and cyclones and killed. It's just great news. And then the other thing is that carbon emissions have peaked in rich countries. They're going to peak in poor countries in the next 10, 20 years, maybe most. Some people think they've peaked already. I don't. But and so we're probably most likely going to be come in around 3 degrees increase in temperatures globally over pre-industrial levels. It, you know, any increase in temperature does create changes to how we've created our society and what the habitats that we've set aside for animals are. So any increase in temperatures does create problems. There are benefits too, but it definitely creates more problems. So you don't want to have high temperatures if you can avoid them, all else being equal. But you know, the guy that won the Nobel Prize for economics on climate change, the Yale University professor William Nordhaus, said the optimal level for balancing costs and benefits was 4 degrees. So now we're going to hit 3 degrees. It's not the end of the world. Again, closer to
literally,
two, we get
literally and figuratively, not the end of the
there
world.
There is, yeah. And so I open that first, I'm going to publish it. I'm just going to give away the first chapter. I think I should be my publisher to just give away the first chapter. And I wanted to, I go through that evidence that you describe. And then I say, does any of that sound like the end of the world? Let's go to the end of the world and see what life is actually like there. And if you go to the Congo, the difference between the Congo and my home in Berkeley is that we have, like, when the rain floods down my hillside here, we have a flood control system that makes sure my house is not washed away. They don't have that in the Congo. They don't have electrical grid that functions properly. I do. There's nothing in any climate scenario that's going to basically wipe out our roads and electrical systems and sewage systems or flood control systems. And yet that's the way that that's the way that climate change is described in these apocalyptic scenarios, which you can't find in anything in the IPCC. IPCC doesn't even suggest that we, I mean, I think I've been trying to, I've been looking at this question of, could you ever say that anybody, that you think anybody will die? I think I can safely say nobody should die from climate change. I don't see a scenario where that death toll that's declined from disasters will go up. Now, this is, let me make a point on this because I think it's important. I'm going to write something about this. People who say climate change is making disasters worse are either deliberately misleading you, completely ignorant, or they are using a definition of disasters that the IPCC and scientists don't use. A hurricane on its own is not a disaster. What a disaster is, according to IPCC, is the effect of the hurricane on deaths and costs, people and whatever. It's the interaction between the weather event and the thing. So I'm trying to get the scientist to tell me how she's claiming that climate change is making disasters worse. When how would you be able to claim that if the deaths from disasters are going down? You'd have to sort of imagine that they would have gone down more. If you had
and
less
that's,
temperature
and
increase.
Deaths are going down, even though everybody around the globe have developed much more along coastlines, along places that are more likely to have extreme weather events.
Yeah, and they experienced like a 90 or God, even higher percent decline in deaths from cyclones in the Indian Basin just by having better weather because of they're better predicting, better able to predict weather. And then they have storm shelters, but super low costs. Like really it wasn't. So on the one hand, you kind of go, well, we're more wealthy, so we're more protected from natural disasters, which is true. But some of it's just cheap stuff. But I mean, I'm kind of like, I can't figure out if you kind of go, hurricanes are getting a little bit more severe. The fire season's a bit longer. It's just outweighed by other factors, you know? So in the fires, I point out that it's the buildup of wood fuel in forests, and it's building houses near forests that explain all of the increase in fuel in fire frequency and severity. In the case of floods, it's whether you have a flood control system or not. I mean, the New York Times has been running these news stories like hyping flood threat, and you're kind of like, well, so then we'll make our flood systems better. I mean, it's not like it's not like somehow we're all going to be flooded because of climate change. They make it sound almost biblical in the threat it poses, as opposed to fairly modest changes that were very easily, especially in rich countries, able to adapt to.
And so, I mean, is the equation for you as simple as, or as direct rather, as if you care about people, the good news is that fewer people are dying from weather, fewer people are dying from pollution or environmental degradation as we're getting better at that. And the way to kind of supercharge all of that is to increase general wealth.
I mean, obviously, yeah. I mean, we should, mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many reasons to increase wealth. So obviously that should be a major goal. Economic growth should be it is, and it already is, mm-hmm. of course, at the highest priority. But you basically see what you get with the Malthusian left is they say we have to do this, I mean, the Democrats just put out another terrible, just a mash of bad spending on climate stuff. It doesn't, mm-hmm. first of all, most of it doesn't actually reduce emissions, doesn't have anything to do with carbon emissions, jobs programs and all this stuff. I mean, some of it might be fine. I mean, I might be fine with some of it. I'm not even saying it's all bad. I'm just saying it's not about climate change. And a lot of the emphasis in terms of renewables, I point out, is that precisely because renewables make energy expensive. That was not a bug. That was a feature of renewables as it's always been imagined in every Green New Deal. I helped create one.
And the idea there is if it's more expensive, you use less of it.
Yeah, it's a very crude model of basically making energy more scarce and slowing down this virus of growth. It's just a degrowth, anti-growth agenda masquerading itself in green clothing in a variety of ways. That's why I think the watermelon that gets said sometimes, I think on the libertarian front, you know, where people see greens as just watermelons, I don't think it's quite the
so
same.
So that means
in the
green,
sense that,
green on the outside and red communist on the inside,
Marx, there's an anti-growth quality here that wasn't either so explicit or it wasn't really central to what Marxism and socialism were supposedly about.
Yeah, quite. I mean, Marxism was also trying to get to a post-scarcity world, and it's fascinating that kind of the modern environmental movement is really about intensifying scarcity.
Right. Yeah. So it's about, I basically, the book is in, you know, it's in three, I don't have it broken into three parts in the book, but basically the first third is everything you've been told about the environment is wrong. It's just a debunking of climate deforestation, plastic straws, species extinctions. The second third is how do humans actually save the natural environment? Like in the real world, how did we save the whales? Mm-hmm. You know, that's urbanization, industrialization, substitution. You know, we save sea turtles by not making glasses out of their shells anymore. We use plastics. And then the last third is like how, if environmental problems are manageable, if many of the trends are going in the right direction, if there's really no like scientific basis for imagining some catastrophic events from climate change, what's going on? What is this about?
Right.
And so I basically just summarize it as money, power, and religion. And while I think money and power are really important, obviously I wrote whole chapters on them. I think there are independent factors behind this. I think this is at bottom, this is people constructing an alternative religion.
So this is because of the general secularization of the world. We still have a religious impulse, and it's being rooted in a kind of transcendental but symbolic love of nature.
Yeah, and the problem with it is that it doesn't acknowledge it. In other words, if I'm a Jew and you're a Christian or a Muslim or whatever, and we're like, I'm a Jew, I'm a Christian, I'm a Muslim, that's who I am. But it's my religion. And then I have science. I mean, you know, most religious people, very few don't, very few reject science. Most religious people are like, I got my religion and then I've got my science. And then there's kind of a science, and there's sort of two different, when I go to church, I'm at church. When I'm reading IPCC reports, it's something else. Environmentalists, because they don't think that they're in the grip of a religion, they start treating nature as a new god. They start treating science as a new religion. And that's when things just go absolutely bonkers and problematic.
Let me ask you to work through kind of how do you convert is the wrong word, but how do you engage somebody constructively if they are kind of thinking religiously without acknowledging it? And to go back to renewables, you know, it's interesting to hear you talk about how part of the whole point of renewables was to increase the cost of energy so that even if it wasn't destroying, you know, even if we weren't sucking oil out of the earth and, you know, and ruining things that way, We have renewable energy, but it's going to be more expensive. So even though it doesn't despoil the environment, we use less of it. Can you quickly kind of sketch, is the problem with renewables now that they are too expensive compared to other alternatives, or is it that they don't work at scale, or is it a combination of both of those?
So think of it this way, that there's basically, you know, renewables are for, you know, pre-industrial subsistence farming societies. Mm-hmm. They're low energy density. It's wood, sunlight, water, wind. They're all very low energy density fuels or flows. Fossil fuels are much bigger increases in energy density. They're what allow us to have cities. You can't have renewable powered cities. We did try. We had horse-drawn carriages and you had horse feces everywhere and disease right. and all sorts of problems. So with electricity, then also you can have elevators and the buildings can go higher until you get to nuclear, where really you've completely dematerialized your power source. So the problem with renewables is just, it's just physics. You know, this Michael Moore movie, which got all this controversy, which documents the big environmental problems of renewables, they document the big environmental problems with renewables, but then they kind of suggest that it's because of capitalism.
Right.
As though like a solar farm wouldn't require 400 times more land in a socialist society. Mm-hmm. Solar farm requires 400 times more land than a natural gas plant or a nuclear plant because of the physics of sunlight or wind. I mean, you know, it's just, there's just nothing. Well, the solar panels have become 2% or 10% more efficient. Okay, so then it'll be just 360 times more land. There's no, and that's, by the way, that's, it's actually been 2% efficiency improvement over 10 years, not 10. So you're talking about, so, and then there's just the unreliability of it. You know, you have to have reliable power for it to be cheap power. Every time you're moving electricity out of the grid into a battery or something else and then back in, you're getting two energy conversions. So renewables, you know, they're doing a lot of work for people. Renewables are doing the work for Malthusians of trying of at least a fantasy of moving to a low energy society. They're obviously a place that people, that crony capitalists can make a lot of money just subsidy farming. Mm-hmm. And then they're providing the spiritual fantasy of harmonizing human societies with nature, which is the whole point. Mm-hmm. So renewables, just a, you know, renewables and organics and humans are now making themselves right by nature in the same way that Christians wanted to make themselves right by God. And so it's a new morality. Anybody that opposes renewables is immoral.
Right.
Right. And satanic in some sense. And nuclear itself is kind of satanic. It plays a satanic role in this new cosmology, which is so powerful because it's so unconscious. So part of the reason I wanted to write Apocalypse Never was just to, let's just make it conscious and just kind of go, if you want to justify your religion, fine. But then I think you need to explain to everybody why it's worth the devastating impact it has on the natural environment, why it's worth the big cost increases, the increases that it forces in the electricity system. Because often what renewables are doing is they're externalizing their cost, the managing the radical unreliability of wind turbines. Suddenly it's like 5 a.m. or 4 a.m. and all this energy is on the grid. Mm-hmm. You have to pay people to take it. Like, it's just not, like, this is not great energy. It's often producing large amounts of garbage energy. So, you know, you kind of go at the bottom, you kind of go, how, you know, what could possibly allow such terrible energy to be viewed as something so good?
Right.
Only a religion could perform that.
Right. Do you find and obviously you have, you know, throughout your career, you engage mostly, you know, environmentalists and people like that. Are people receptive, are, you know, hardcore Greens receptive to being told you are in the throes of a religion that you can't even see because you're so deep into it?
Well, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I, you know, I guess the question is, because we live in a world where, you know, we have the Democratic Party, basically every one of their presidential candidates had signed on to some version of the Green New Deal, or at least paid lip service to it. You know, in an environmental, I mean, in a profound way, I think we are all environmentalists now, in the sense that we think about the costs and benefits of choices, of energy choices. And I'm old enough to remember the public service ads to treat, you know, to teach people not to just throw garbage out the window of a car on a highway. I mean, we had to work, we all think in environmental terms, if, you know, in terms of cost benefit to the surrounding areas. But it looks like we're about to make a great leap forward into a very extreme version of it. So what is the target audience, I guess, in a way, for your book? Is it to get hardcore greens to, you know, kind of change the way they're thinking? Is it to get, I mean, there's a sizable group of people, including in the Republican Party, who are like, nothing is wrong that can't be fixed by just, you know, dumping crude oil everywhere. You know, I mean, how do you convert people to what your position is, which strikes me as like eminently sensible?
So, I mean, I wrote this book for so many different audiences. I mean, I definitely had conservatives on my mind while I was writing it. I definitely had progressives on my mind for writing it. They should be getting different things out of it if it's working. So for conservatives, I think the most important thing to do is to just get grounded, truly do get grounded in the science. There's still a lot of guys out there on the right who think that they're either the planet's not really warming, or that carbon dioxide is not a molecule.
As our esteemed president calls it, you know, that climate change is a hoax, right? It's perpetrated by the Chinese government somehow. And I don't even want to try and diagram that, you know, that flow chart. But
I think it's a kind of a troll, honestly. I don't really know that anybody that says that actually believes it. There's definitely some sunspots people. But, you know, I testified in front of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. And in January, and like not a single Republican was a climate denier,
right?
You know, and they were all asking questions and they had other concerns, but it wasn't this kind of the old caricature. And certainly Trump obviously is responsible for some of that. So, but the old caricature I don't find is true among like most Republicans.
Oh, that's good.
You know, I think that most Republicans didn't know. I talk a little bit about how as the environmental movement became Malthusian, the right actually became anti-Malthusian, even though Malthus is truly a conservative in just the kind of true conservative sense, and why that was. And so I think that it's sort of the same reason libertarians ended up on the right, I think, in the United States. So I think that there's sort of like a just kind of reject all that. Because look, the IPCC science is like fine. IPCC policy recommendations are stupid and just reflect the green agenda, and we should criticize them. I'm actually a reviewer. I criticized them recently. Yeah. But I think if the conservatives were to actually get a more scientific view on climate change and to adopt this more humanistic view that I'm proposing, which says, look, it's not like you're ever satisfied with your energy source, just like you're never satisfied with your food production. You always want to improve it. But the key is to be going in the direction of higher power densities, not in the direction of lower power densities, because that requires more nature, more material, more matter, more natural environment must be ground up to produce either electricity or food or products or whatever. And Republicans, I think, have been articulating something close, but it's been around the economy. And therefore, they've ended up reinforcing the sense that there's some necessary trade-off between the economy and the environment. But the truth is, like France, 75% nuclear, it's not poor because it has 75% nuclear. I think you could actually argue that it's rich. Right. So I think that there's been a confusion on this. I wanted to write this book for conservatives and Republicans and libertarians.
Okay, so then...
And then for progressives, obviously, they just... Yeah.
Well, talk a bit of how...
Oh, it's just a quick... Just on progressives, it's just getting similarly. It's getting to the energy power... Yeah. Yeah, it's just the progressives. It's just going also similarly getting your head screwed on right with the science and being like, renewables are problems because of low power densities. And this is just nothing to do with capitalism or the man or whatever. Right. Like, that's just a problem with your fuels, and that actually,
Well, do you have a sense? It seems you mentioned you're a Gen Xer. I'm a late baby boomer, and you know, your argument makes perfect sense to me, and I suspect to a lot of Gen Xers. For millennials, Gen Z, younger Americans, the environment regularly shows up in kind of polls and surveys as a very high order principle, and kind of moving towards a, you know, fully renewable post-carbon kind of energy future. Why do you think that is? And how do you reach younger people of whatever kind of ideological orientation?
I mean, look, it's a religion. I mean, it's just a complete, we're in a total religious revival. It's supposedly secular, but I think I look at, I don't work on race, but I listen to John McWhorter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, John McWhorter was doing one of his things with Glenn Lowry. And I think I saw you interview Glenn Lowry.
Yep.
And I think McWhorter goes, McWhorter goes, I'm gonna write a book on how anti-racism is the new religion. And I was I just did that on the environment.
Yeah.
And it's like I haven't spent any time trying to figure out how they kind of work together. Mm-hmm. But it's like the same people that are in the street around anti-racism were in the street around climate apocalypse. So I mean, I think, you know, the death of God, secularization, first of all, people need something to believe in.
Right.
You know, that includes like some view of their own immortality, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. That's actually, I think it's part of being human. You know, the argument I make is that actually our awareness of our mortality creates anxiety that then, this is, I'm taking this from a major anthropologist who wrote on this, makes us want to have some kind of legacy. That's natural. That's okay. Makes us want to feel heroic. That's great.
Yeah.
Be aware of it. Don't, you know, pretend like you don't need that or want that. And then I think you need a new morality. This whole thing of the obsession with plastic straws, mm-hmm. you know, the I'm vegetarian. I show these things are of no importance.
Can I ask you, I try to eat vegan and I do that mostly for calories, not for ethical reasons, but you have a stat in the book, which put me back on my heels. It's that if everybody adopted a vegetarian diet, how much of the earth would that save from farming?
It's basically,
what is the metric? Carbon emissions?
You mean? Yeah. I was gonna say, I mean, carbon emissions, it's 2-4%.
Right. So it's basically nothing.
Yeah, just nothing. You should not. And not only that, but like, I can explain why basically, like, it doesn't even work out that if you became vegetarian, you could sort of be like, there's more wilderness because there's less pasture. The big thing on and how much land we use for meat is just whether are you spreading your cows all over the hillsides like Michael Pollan and the organicists want us to do, or are you confining them in the evil industrial farming way? Because the evil industrial farming way leaves more of the earth to the natural environment, obviously,
right?
Like, just, I don't need to provide any math. I mean, just think about it. You concentrate 100 cows over 100 miles of land versus, you know, 1 mile.
Right.
One of the things that I
really appreciate about the book, too, is that you're not just, you know, picking off, you know, certain things for your argument. I mean, you talk about how there is a massive reforestation of the planet, which is a good thing. You know, we have more plants, more trees, less land is being used for food production and energy production and things like that. But then that there are also problems with kind of forests that are planted by, you know, people who are creating timber forests, right?
I mean, yeah, everybody knows that an old growth forest is just, if you've ever been in an old growth forest, it's like for me, it's one of my peak spiritual existential peak experiences. Old growth redwood forests or old growth oak forests, they feel different. They feel like you're in a cathedral. If you're in some tree farm, so I point out, yeah, there's reforestation, but it's not exactly, it's not what you, there's real loss in the Amazon. The bigger dynamic is that by promoting bad forms of agriculture, Greenpeace has encouraged fragmentation of the primary forest, primary old growth forest, which we need if you're gonna have like big cat species that can move around hundreds of kilometers of space. You need these big apex predators. And so they fragmented it because they actually thought that there was something wrong with concentrated, industrialized, intensified agriculture, when that's the key. That's the most important thing when it comes to saving the natural environment, what we call the natural environment, conservation. It's concentrating animal production, concentrating food production, intensifying food production, more food on less land. It's just obvious. It's physics. There's no advanced physics. It's just simple when you think about it. And yet the dogmatism and the religiosity then has resulted in real ecological harm, not just harm to people.
Could you, I want to get to, I want to hear you make the best case possible for nuclear power, ubiquitous nuclear power in a second. But just as a specific point, you had mentioned this in passing about how the next or the sixth extinction is not going to happen. It's not happening. This is something that we hear a lot. It's like plastic straws, killing all sorts of sea life. You know, these are the kind of talking points or aphorisms of the environmentalist movement. What is going on with extinctions, and why should we not be overly concerned right now that, you know, we're going to wake up, you know, by the fall, most of our species are going to be extinct?
Let me tell you what we should first be concerned about, and I'll tell you what you shouldn't be concerned about. We should just be concerned that humans have a large footprint. We take up a lot of the earth. There's just not as much habitat for endangered species as we would want. Poverty in particular often drives people into forested or grassland areas, converts them into farming or ranching, and that is how you get loss of habitat. It's also how you get wild animal consumption. So that's what you want to worry about. Extinction, because it's such a powerful word, is used by scientists to advance public relations and advocacy for their conservation agenda. The problem is that we're not in the sixth mass extinction. We would be, I mean, you'd have to be, the share of extinctions has to be just enormous. We're just at a very tiny, and it's, you know, and the other thing that actually people don't realize is that what happened was the way they construct this is they create these models where they assume a certain amount of loss of habitat would lead to a certain number of extinctions. Well, they were wrong. The models always overestimated extinctions. Just turns out species are actually, many animal and plant and other species are just good at occupying less and less land. Mm-hmm. It's kind of sad, actually. I mean, it's right. Kind of amazing as well, but it's not like extinction is like, in other words, we're really good at maintaining a lot of species diversity. Even if you just don't have, you know, enough, I think for me, half of all wild animals, we have half the number of wild animals in the world today that we had in 1960. That's the issue. If you just care about wild animals and you want more wild animals, that's too bad. We should have been eating cows and pigs and chickens instead of eating all those animals and taking their habitat. So that's why the extinction. And then the other problem with the extinction stuff is that it's just very apocalyptic. Like if you kind of, I quote this conservation scientist who goes, if you believe all that sixth extinction stuff, then why would you bother? You know, like, why would you bother saving things? It's just wrong and stupid. One of the things I did in this book very deliberately, very carefully, is I got the key scientists on the phone that often make these apocalyptic claims. I interviewed them like a proper reporter would, which amazingly no environmental reporters had done before me. And basically got them on the record admitting that, you know, either they were bullshitting basically or grossly exaggerating, you know, or in the case of the species extinctions one, I just got some of the main scientists to just go on the record and just be like, no, you're right. We're not in the midst of a sixth extinction.
So,
you know, like, and it's like, okay, then why did you guys tell everybody that for like the last 10 goddamn years, you know?
Well, how, you know, from a lay position, you know, and we live in both simultaneously, and I guess these things are related, an age of experts and an absolute loss of faith in experts, confidence in experts and institutions. Yeah. What are the tells that you're being sold a line of BS on environmental claims? You spend a fair amount of time in the book, and it makes for good reading, but it's infuriating looking at the tactics and the claims of the group Extinction Rebellion, which is primarily or very big in England. But how do you know when people are kind of stretching for true claims?
Well, I mean, this book, I look at things like healthcare, you know, as like complicated. I look at energy and the environment as not that complicated. I mean, in some ways you just go, those things I mentioned, you know, declining death tolls, you know, from natural disasters. Someone starts talking about people dying, any number, millions or billions, you have to be like, what is the mechanism for that? What is the mechanism? Like, how will those people die? Oh, well, we might run out of food. Well, actually, it turns out most everybody agrees that as long as the poor countries using fertilizer irrigation tractors and have roads, we're going to produce much more food than we produce today. We produce 25% more food than we need. Obesity is a problem. We throw away huge amounts of food. That's great. I mean, in some ways it's great. It's terrible, the waste, but it is kind of a sign that we're secure and wealthy and that's not the issue. So, you know, and then in terms of like, this story about energy moving from lower energy densities, both on energy and food production, as well as cities, by the way, power densities increase in like down in like Manhattan is like insanely high power density. Singapore, right? High power densities. These little rural parts of Congo is super low. So just understanding that and that energy substitutes for matter, that you can leave the natural environment by using more energy to protect it, to save it. I think these things, once people get that framework, this is like the last, I'm not going to do another book on the environment. I've already decided. Like, I've just got other things I want to do. I write other articles, but like this book actually, there's a secretly I've hidden an environmental studies textbook in this book. It has all of the science. It has the basic framework that you should get in your environmental studies textbook and are not getting. So I do feel like once you read this book, your brain will be able to detect the bullshit.
Okay. Well, let's let's try it out and see if I can detect bullshit from you when you talk about nuclear power. And, you know, we talked a bit about how, okay, you know, the nuclear age is born in, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the mushroom cloud. That's terrifying. And then, you know, we still have God knows where more than enough nuclear weapons to blow up the planet a million times over and all of that. We have nuclear power in parts of the world. France overwhelmingly, you know, generates the electricity by that. Places like Japan, places like Russia. But, you know, then the history of nuclear power seems to be littered with these warning signs, these blips, or more than blips, Fukushima, Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, which not in the same league, I guess. But why should we be moving towards nuclear? You know, and also, then is it actually affordable in any kind of meaningful way?
I mean, I think the first thing you have to understand about nuclear, you have to appreciate what it is. It is a revolutionary moment in human evolution. It's a completely radical new technology. Okay. It is, and we knew it would be like literally before it was invented in the early 1900s, before they had even split the atom. There was books describing how once we got nuclear energy, it would both open up the possibility of super bombs, huge bombs, and limitless energy, basically. Right. Limitless clean energy. They didn't quite use that word, but that was where they were talking about. So that's the first thing. The second thing is you get it at the lab level. I mean, the Manhattan Project required this huge, only the US government could have done it with massive wartime mobilization. But splitting the atom happens in the lab. I mean, that's just, and they literally, as soon as the word gets out that they did it, they replicate it. Everybody replicates it in their lab around the world. So this is not something where you can just kind of be like smallpox, where you can be like, well, okay, we'll have some smallpox in a couple of freezers in the United States and Russia. Like this comes right out of human knowledge. So what that means is, so first of all, I mean, one of the things so interesting I discovered in the research for Apocalypse Never was, like really right after the bomb, this group of scholars at Yale and some guys from Harvard too, they figured out right away what it would mean. In fact, Niels Bohr, the Nobel Prize winning Danish physicist who visits Manhattan Project, sees Oppenheimer, goes up to him and is like, this is going to change everything. This is going to end war. I mean, like literally they were like, it's going to end war. And then it freaked them out because of what it meant for it to end war. And so there was some backpedaling and how do we control it and whatever. But basically, long story short, like it was clear that this weapon is truly terrifying. And in fact, that's how it works. If it wasn't so terrifying, it wouldn't be creating peace between India, China, India, Pakistan.
Right.
You know, and other
the
countries.
Soviets and, so, and the West.
And us. And the Chinese and whatever. But that is so kind of horrible. In the sense that was what, like, I remember talking to a friend of mine who's progressive, very much a UN type, you know, and I was like, well, it just sounds like it just upsets you that this is what it took to kind of tame the human beast. She was like, yeah, it's horrible. Like it was supposed to happen through brotherly love and reason.
Right.
And this was Kant's whole idea.
So that's the.
So I think that was.
That's the weaponry. Then how do we, make the case for it as the best power source for the future?
So then you get to the energy, and it was obvious to everybody that it was going to be the best form of energy, like just because of all the reasons we know now: the high power densities, the fact that there's no air and water pollution, the fact that the so-called waste is just these used fuel rods that can be stored on site. Tiny quantities of which never hurt anybody, never will hurt anybody. That was all that. And there was almost a manic enthusiasm for nuclear energy in the 50s, in part, I think, as a kind of like way to make this terrifying new reality more palatable. But that then didn't last very long. And then the Malthusians start going after nuclear. The the Quakers and Mennonites and pacifists and others start going after nuclear weapons. And then it eventually just displaces itself onto nuclear energy, both deliberately and through concerted political action. Mm-hmm. And then so your question, and this is all my way of getting to your question, the accidents, whatever. Mm-hmm. First of all, it'd be like saying, like when you kind of go, well, I don't know, chemistry. You know, chemistry, look at all the accidents with chemistry. I mean, it's kind of like if there's a whole new field of science, which is what nuclear, a whole new field of science, a whole new industrial capacity, like you kind of go, well, of course there's going to be a shitload of accidents. Mm-hmm. Like you're kind of like, I'm kind of amazed there haven't been more, right, and that they haven't been worse. And that's what we keep finding. I point out that basically the radiation that escapes from these accidents, just not the super potent toxin that people imagine. Mm-hmm. There's not very much of it because of the high power densities. Meaning that it's just, you know, nuclear fuel rods, you know, as opposed to coal and wood, you're just putting a lot of material, particulate matter into the environment. Very little of that escapes from nuclear. So I go, the overreaction to those accidents is displacement. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of the reactors melted and like 3 Mile Island. And it's like, right, wow, okay, yeah, that's, and there's that kind of, we knew that would happen. And it was like, you know, this is a first generation. And then like, did anybody, I mean, so how many people were killed in this major industrial accident? Oh, nobody. So, okay, Fukushima, how many people were killed with radiation there? Oh, nobody. Chernobyl, you kind of dig down into it. At best, you can kind of count 200 dead bodies over like an 80-year period. So you, so ultimately, nothing, if you believe that science, and I document all in the book, I have the best expert on it, blah, 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 then something else is going on. And clearly, the bomb is a big part of that. Now, it's, again, it's more progressives than conservatives who are worried about nuclear. It's more women than men, you know, so there's other things going on there. But nonetheless, I think that's the big animating factor that freaks us out about the technology.
My understanding of nuclear plants in the United States, at the very least, and I think this may be true in Europe as well, is that they really, once they're up and running, if you can assume a plant has been built and is running, it's incredibly cost effective compared to carbon or oil, gas, things like that. But that it takes an enormous amount of subsidies to put a plant in operation. Is that accurate, or how would you address that?
No, it's not. They're not subsidies. There are, I guess you could argue that loan guarantees are a subsidy, but it doesn't have to be with subsidies. It can also just be, you know, under the traditional regulated public utility model, where you have a natural monopoly in the form of electric company, because you don't want, you know, more than one electric company stringing up wires everywhere. It's a natural monopoly. We said we're going to either going to be socialist. 30% of U.S. electricity is socialist, basically, publicly owned utilities. 70% is privately owned. Mm-hmm. It's similar to that in Japan, but South Korea, France, and many other countries are just publicly owned utilities. Mm-hmm. And so when they invest, they don't usually need a subsidy. They usually just need to be able to start charging for some of that electricity in advance in order to make the capital that they borrow cheaper. So the most important thing is that you have cheap capital. But it's like what you said. I mean, it's like, if you think that this is important to the civilization, and again, I don't, I'm not suggesting that if we don't do it, that this civilization is in deep threat from climate change. I'm actually just sort of criticizing that. Nonetheless, if you think like, and there's that nuclear is something that you need for civilization, it's just like building a bridge or a highway or a stadium or anything like that. And there's cost overruns, just like there are with those things. You expand the subway, you do the big dig in Boston, you do the high-speed rail in Britain, and those things have cost overruns. But there's no need for, you know, unless it's a, you know, what would basically happen was with deregulation, it made it harder to be able to do the kind of investments that we did with nuclear in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. But we're still able to. It just, we don't really have the, we're just not really set up right to do it.
I guess as a closing thought, are you optimistic that that the kind of high watermark, I'm reaching for bad metaphors here, high watermark fever, high fever, whatever, of kind of environmental alarmism, is that cresting, or do you see that cresting sometime soon? How optimistic are you that the message that you're putting out in your book Apocalypse Never is going to carry the day?
I mean, I think after Apocalypse Never and some of the stuff that we're going to do to call out the really bad science, I think it's going to be increasingly hard to claim that climate change is causing natural disasters, that it will increase deaths from natural disasters in the future. I think that climate change will eventually have the same trajectory as fears of overpopulation had, which is that it will continue to sort of be something that people say and talk about, but it won't have the kind of, it won't be what AOC, the next AOC is crusading on. I do think the left will keep coming around on nuclear. I just hired Zion Lights from Extinction Rebellion, who's the person that is in the book to help us to build nuclear plants in Britain. But I think the point I would make is that until there's some alternative religion, until there's like some national, I mean, whether it's nationalism or socialism or some alternative to the traditional Judeo-Christianity, people are going to keep finding new religions because we need that. So, I mean, for me, the question is, what would the alternative religion, I would argue in some sense, libertarian is a kind of, you know, spiritual, existential, moral worldview. What I'm proposing, environmental humanism, is the same. But I do think that in some ways, there's just the work of Sisyphus that we do have to keep, you know, confronting apocalyptic millenarian ideologies because they are harmful. I mean, they're contributing to anxiety and depression in people. It's being used as a strategy to basically keep poor countries from accessing cheap energy and thus economic growth. So for me, it's more like, I don't know, I can't tell you exactly how big our victory will be, but I do think that the work is essential and you've got to kind of push back on this stuff so it doesn't cause the kind of harm that it's been causing in recent years.
I'm thinking with the myth of Sisyphus, if we could only harness the energy of that boulder rolling down the hill every night, wouldn't need carbon, right?
Yeah. Right.
We'll leave it there. The book is Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All. The author is Michael Schellenberger. Mike, thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Thanks for having me, Nick. Good to see you.
This has been the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts. And while you're there, check out our other shows. Thanks for listening.